For those who don't know me, I'm Paul. I'm the COO for Perimeter. I just started a couple of months ago. Thanks for all joining this seminar today. This seminar is really one of what will be a couple, maybe three seminars around intellectual property and agreements. And we realize that Perimeter, we don't produce really patents right now. You know, it's a breakthrough research center, but we live in an environment that's full of startups, full of venture capital. You interact with lots of people who produce intellectual property. And so we thought it would be really useful just to kind of do a patenting 101 for everybody, kind of what patents are, why would you want them, how do you produce them, you know, what do you cover, and to do that, actually, we've invited just the perfect person to give this talk. I'd like to introduce Michael Henry. Dr. Michael Henry. Michael, he's the principal and the founding member of the Henry Patent Law Firm. It's actually in Texas. Why is Michael perfect for us? Well, actually, he earned his PhD in the Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering at MIT. And his doctoral research focused on developing enhanced control techniques for quantum computers. But more than that, actually, his supervisor was David Corey, who probably is well known to most of the audience today. But Michael obviously then went on to get a law degree and really focuses on intellectual property and patent law. He really works with high-tech companies. He helps them create these patent portfolios that really protect their business and, you know, support their vision. He's actually been a senior associate at top-ranked international patent law firms. He's managed global patent portfolios for Fortune 100 companies. And he has also been an instructor at these firms' national boot camps, where he trained patent attorneys who represented, you know, their technology enterprises. So he's perimeter for Perimeter to advise us and give this presentation today. So Michael, thank you very much for joining us. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to you.
Great, thanks, Paul. Hopefully everyone can hear me. Really excited to be presenting to you guys today. As Paul mentioned, I once was a physicist and loved being a physicist, and went over to the dark side, though, after I finished my PhD. And I was working with David Corey at MIT, which was just opportunity of a lifetime for me. Really enjoyed that. And we actually collaborated with some folks at Perimeter and elsewhere in Waterloo. And so I got a chance as a graduate student to visit Perimeter, and was just completely impressed by, you know, of course, by the facility and the atmosphere, but, you know, above all by the people, and always have been. And so it's really an honor to get to speak to you guys. So thank you for being here and listening. And I'm, as Paul mentioned, I'm in Texas, I'm in the US, and so I'm licensed to practice law in the US. And I only mention that because, you know, patent law, I'm going to be talking about patent law. It is country by country, and there are some differences and nuances in different countries. And so, but largely, you know, Canadian patent law is going to be very similar to US patent law. And just wanted to kind of mention that difference or that nuance. And then throughout the presentation today, and I think you guys will get a copy of these slides, I've put some links to blog posts on our firm's website, where, you know, if you want to find out more about a topic, or if you just prefer to kind of take in information in writing, then that's there for you. So we're, you know, patents are kind of one topic within the broader umbrella of intellectual property. And so today is going to really be about patents, and really from the perspective of what do innovators need to know about patents, or what's useful, most useful for inventors, innovators to know about patents. And so that's kind of the angle that this content takes. And this is based on my experience working with inventors, innovators for the last 15 or so years. And the focus or the specialty of our firm is really working with early stage high-tech companies that are developing emerging technologies and really trying to establish themselves and develop robust patent portfolios that will work to support their business. Let's see if I can click through. Here we go. So this is just a brief outline of what I'm planning to talk about, but I want to say, please feel free to chime in with questions along the way. I think there's a designated Q&A period at the end, but I'd love for this to be a discussion and please don't feel like you need to wait till the end to chime in. I think that folks have the ability to unmute, so you can just interrupt me if you'd like. And then, if you have questions about things that I haven't covered here, then, welcome those questions at the end. Just standard disclaimer, lawyers, we love disclaimers. This is really intended for educational purposes and not legal advice. So if you have a specific question about your specific situation, please consider engaging an attorney to help you with that. Because certainly the facts make all the difference and you'd want to be able to get advice tailored to your specific situation. So kind of zooming out, to the big picture, just thinking about intellectual property as a general topic, there are a lot of different types of intellectual property, and, I'm sure that you guys are familiar with some or all of them. But I think it helps to, if we're going to be talking about patents, to kind of set the stage of, how patents are different from other types of intellectual property that you're probably familiar with. So patents cover inventions, and, that's a very broad term. So inventions can be systems, devices, processes, algorithms, materials. You can even cover biological matter with a patent. Of course, pharmaceuticals are a type of patent that can be very valuable. And patents are distinguished from trade secrets, which cover secret information, as the name implies. But really, trade secret is a business concept. If you have secret, valuable, confidential business information, then that can be a trade secret. Trademarks, you're all familiar with logos. Even the name of a company can be a trademark, but the purpose of a trademark is to tell the consumer or the rest of the world where a product or service comes from. So when you see the Apple logo on a device, you know that it came from Apple, and it helps people discern the quality and the source of the goods that they're buying. Copyrights, of course, are another well-known type of IP, and those cover creative works. You guys might have textbooks or other types of books that you've published, and those, of course, are protected by copyright. Software can be protected by copyright. Artwork, dance moves can be protected by copyright. Copyrights are really for a large variety of creative works.
Can you say something about, you mentioned you can patent an algorithm, you can copyright software. Mm-hmm. I'm implementing the algorithm through some software. Do you do both, or like what determines whether you should be protecting yourself by copywriting your software or patenting your algorithm? How do I think about that distinction?
That's a great question. And a lot of times there is copyright and patent protection, both in parallel. So the code itself, copyright protects the work that's embodied in a tangible medium. Is the way that the statute is phrased. But the actual code in a software aspect would be protected by copyright. But then a patent would be used to cover not just the code, but actually the algorithm, the substance of what the code is doing. So that if someone decided to use the same type of process, but they code it themselves, or they use a different type of code, then the patent would cover that as well. And then trade secret also is sometimes used in parallel, because, you know, to the extent that your source code can be kept secret, and that the software can be deployed, for example, in the cloud where it's not made public, then a lot of times trade secret protection is also available for software.
Hillary, you have a question?
Hiya. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of the difference, or one of the various differences between Canadian and American patent law, is that in the US you can patent knowledge, but not in Canada. You can't, and instead you're allowed to patent the implementation of it. You can patent technology, but the knowledge itself you can't patent in Canada. That's my understanding, anyway.
Yeah, so I think the kind of the general topic that you're referring to is what we call patent eligible subject matter, which means like what types of things can be patented, and it's more a matter of policy. I wouldn't say that knowledge can be patented in the US. The topic that you're referring to, I do see this described in sort of technically inaccurate terms a lot on websites that say, oh, you can't patent an idea, or you can patent an idea or knowledge. But what I think the difference between US and Canadian law is one that's actually changing, has changed over recent years. In the US, you cannot patent an abstract idea, which sounds easy to say, but it actually distinguishing between an abstract idea and something that is not an abstract idea turns out to be non-trivial. And so the meaning of abstract idea, or the scope of what is considered an abstract idea, has expanded in the US over the last 5, 6, 7 years. And so it's become harder to patent anything that might sound abstract in the US, whereas the rest of the world outside the US, including Canada, Europe, Japan, China, have not had this, they don't even have really the idea of abstract ideas, that it's not even a concept in other countries. So patent eligible subject matter, and I have a slide that mentions this later, and this could be a whole day of presentation, but that is one area that varies most significantly, I think, from country to country. So yeah, it's a good question. So this slide is really, what is a patent? And there's really just a couple of points that I wanted to highlight here. In basic terms, the patent is a limited monopoly. So it gives the patent owner the right to exclude others from making, selling, using, importing the invention for about 20 years. I think the important nuance here is that it does not give anyone the right to make, use, or sell the invention. This is a common misperception. People think that, oh, I got a patent, that means that I can go out and sell my invention and I won't infringe anyone else's rights. But actually, that's not the case. The patent only gives you the right to exclude the patent owner. It gives the patent owner the right to exclude others. And so it could be that you have a patent, but you still don't have the right to sell your patented product if someone else's patent also covers it. And then, of course, patents are territorial, which just means that they're granted on a country-by-country basis. There are international patent applications, and there are also regional patent applications. For example, in Europe, you can file one patent application that covers almost all of Europe. But you don't actually get a European patent. Instead, you take your patent application after it's approved and validate it in each individual country that you want to cover. There is actually some prospect. I just got an email this morning talking about how the so-called unitary patents in Europe, where you could get one patent that would cover all of Europe, is there has been some recent progress toward that. So if that's a topic that you've heard about, then that's still kind of an ongoing thing. But patents are granted by a patent office, and each country or region has its own patent office that does its own examination process, which is usually a pretty long and arduous process that involves mostly written correspondence, but sometimes also live or telephonic discussions, interviews with patent examiners. Patents can be sold. They are considered transferable property. So they can be sold, licensed, a lot like real property or personal property. And then finally, patents give you an enforceable right. It's also a challengeable right. And so if someone isn't respecting your patent, then you can enforce your patent with a lawsuit. And they also can challenge your patent in a lawsuit or the patent office procedure. So those are just some big bullet points about patents. Patents are important for businesses. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this, but you know, there's the obvious reason that businesses like exclusivity. So I think that's kind of the default main reason that businesses like to get patents, so that they can have market share. But also patents are good for kind of image and brand. You know, a company that's getting lots of patents is sort of perceived as an innovator, and the patents themselves have value. And so they actually are, you know, can be attributed a certain value, monetary value for fundraising and things like that. And then patents also can be used to generate revenue. So a lot of large companies, they have patents that they don't actually use the technology that's patented, but they license out that technology to other companies. And then the company that owns the patent collects a royalty. And then there's also additional value for the inventors, which sort of, it's a public documentation of what you as an inventor have contributed to the company. And a lot of companies have incentives and awards for their inventors. But I know that for inventors who are working in a corporate context, you know, patents are public, and so they can list their patents on their CV or their resume, and that sort of shows what they've contributed in a very objective way, which a lot of times otherwise wouldn't be visible outside the company. So this is just you can look at the details if you want later, but this kind of just shows big tech companies that are getting lots of patents. IBM is always, this is US patents granted in 2020 and 2019. And IBM has been the leader in just the number of patents granted, but all of the so-called GAFMA or whatever acronym you want to use, all of the big tech companies are getting lots and lots of patents, and they're always in the top, you know, 20 or 50 of patenting companies. And so, you know, you'll hear different sort of policy positions from big tech companies, and a lot of them might say patents are bad or patents are terrible, but they are actually the most prolific users of the patent system as well. And so in the context of big companies and small companies and the value of patents to companies, I wanted to kind of talk through just a couple of different stories that illustrate how you as an innovator could sort of potentially, I guess, leverage the value of patents, or how you might find yourself not leveraging the value of patents in another scenario. I've got these two cartoons that one of them is here on the screen, and there's another one after this. But these are actually, I developed these probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, based on a few real world stories that, you know, cases that I had worked on. And these are, of course, cartoonized, fictionalized, but, you know, over the last, however long, 10 years, I've realized that these stories are not unique at all. And in fact, they are, quite typical of what happens in a lot of different scenarios. And, I think that, it's helpful, to just have these kind of, these prototype stories in mind. So the first, we've got a tale of two inventors. The first inventor, he has his great idea, you know, always symbolized by a light bulb. He has his great idea, and he thinks, hey, this could be really valuable in a business context. Maybe there's a startup here, or maybe there's a company that wants to pay me for this idea. And so this inventor will, you know, potentially in the second block here, the inventor is sort of, quote, collaborating with people, talking to people, sharing some aspects of the idea. And one of the people is, you know, an acquaintance at Big Corp, which is, I guess, a big tech company. And so the inventor is collaborating without any kind of legal protection, if you will. And the individual at Big Corp says, oh, that's a great idea. Look at all these different things that we could do with this idea. And so they innovate around this idea, and they start, Big Corp starts patenting their inventions that build on the basic idea. So they're not patenting the inventor's original idea, but they're extending it and further developing it and patenting those ideas. And this is all unknown to the inventor. And then at some point later, the inventor goes to Megacorp, which is, you know, some competing tech company. And Megacorp says, you know, that's a great idea, but look, you know, we can't actually use this idea because Big Corp has all the patents around it, and we'll get sued by them. And so we, you know, Megacorp decides not to invest in this invention. And of course, the inventor is sad and disappointed at the end. I think one thing that, just sticking with this story, this is actually, like I said, it's not uncommon for this type of thing to happen. And it's also legal, because there wasn't any kind of legal protection for the inventor when they were collaborating with Big Corp. Big Corp, you know, hasn't done anything wrong here. Yes, question.
Yes, so I have a question about your top right quadrant. So suppose that your inventor is like us, a scientist, and you've published basically your idea. Most of us, we publish, and then Big Corp has not even done any kind of collaboration. Can Big Corp just see your papers you've published and just maybe file patents on that?
So that's a great question. So, and there is a little bit, I've got a slide that goes into more detail on this later, but the short answer is no, Big Corp cannot patent what the inventor has published. In a similar way, Big Corp cannot patent what the inventor told them, you know, the symbolized by the light bulb here. But Big Corp can take the publication or the original idea, and they can further develop it, add something to it, you know, something non-trivial, but something small, like an implementation detail, and they can get a patent on that. And so that, you know, I've seen a scenario, a specific one that I have in mind, where it was a university professor that reached out to a former colleague that was at a big company, and that big company, you know, basically said, hey, if, you know, that's a great idea. If you were actually going to put that on a device, here's three or four things you need to do. And they patented those three or four things. And then, of course, the inventor was sort of blocked out of commercializing the invention after that. So it does happen. So here's the sort of round two, different outcome, different scenario. So here the inventor has this great idea. And but here the first thing the inventor does is he or she goes to the patent office and files a patent application. And then, you know, as the patent application is pending, with the patent office, there's some, it's called patent prosecution, there's some negotiation, but eventually the inventor gets their own patents, and then the inventor takes their own patents to Megacorp, and Megacorp, you know, sees dollar signs and gets excited and says, great, we can finally beat Big Corp, and so the inventor gets some reward, cash money, I guess, for this idea. Because, you know, in this cartoon version, they took the proactive step of filing patent applications and getting patents.
Michael, I wonder if you could just touch on this. I'm not sure we're in touch later, but that's the difference between first to invent and first to file. And it's an important distinction, right? Because the change in the patent laws.
Yeah. So there is, this could get complex very quickly, but you're exactly right that the U.S. patent system changed from a first to invent system to a first to file system, which actually the rest of the world was already kind of in that regime before the US made that change about 10 years ago. And so the idea is that, you know, it used to be that if a person invented something, but someone else filed first, that the first inventor could sort of use their earlier invention date to get the patent. And actually in the scenario that I'm talking about, even under a first to file system, I think this would play out the same, which is where, and going back to the first story. So Big Corp didn't actually patent the inventor's idea. They patented some other concepts that were an extension of the idea. And so that would still work in a first to file system. So this is, I guess you could call it a cautionary tale, but it, like I said, it is, I think, fairly representative of what happens a lot. And so, oh yes, we got another question.
My question would just be, so it's like if the inventor would file the patent around the central idea, but the big corp company would file the patents around it, then so it's like there would still be problems, right? So it's like the inventor could then be pressured by big corp in some way, because the only way to make for the inventor to make profit then is to sell the already filed patents to big corp for a smaller fee than probably megacorp would have paid, something like that.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. That's a great question, and you're exposing the oversimplification of my cartoon. But I mean, I think to kind of address your question, it sounds like what you're referring to would be like, here, let's suppose the inventor had filed a patent application on the basic idea first, and then got a patent on that basic idea, and then Big Corp still got these other patents on extensions of the idea. Then you would kind of end up in a scenario where neither one could practice the invention without permission from the other. And so you could end up in a cross-licensing scenario or litigation. But no, you're exactly right. It's it can get very complex very fast with multiple different companies. And that's, you know, another reason, and I get into this later in the slides, that really even disclosing to a company under NDA sometimes can be risky. But it's a good question. Looks like there's another question coming in.
Yeah, I got another one. If you publish your idea in a research journal, once it's published, does that mean that you can't patent it under a first to file jurisdiction? Because I was warned off to be careful about this years ago, and I don't know if it's still true.
Yes, you're exactly right. So So if you publish something in most countries, then you are precluded from patenting it if you didn't file your patent application before you published. So you publish a research paper and then you file your patent application. Most countries would say, sorry, you know, you published this before you filed, you're done. The US has a 1-year grace period for publications by the inventor, but it's not easy to use that grace period. There's a lot of risks. So what I always tell people is, you know, don't use the grace period as a strategy. Use it as a remedy if you messed up and need to go back and try to get some patent protection for something you already published. But also to know that this grace period, there is also a grace period in Canada, but it's slightly different than the grace period in the US and also is limited. So as a general best practice, one should always file patent applications before publishing.
All right. So I got a little follow-up question. Does that scenario, because I mean, not every jurisdiction has a grace period.
Right.
So as I understand it, so if you publish something, I don't know, on the preprint server or what have you, you might be able to patent it in those jurisdictions that have a grace period. But could somebody else patent it in a jurisdiction that doesn't? Like, I think the UK and Europe don't, if I remember rightly. So you could end up with two different entities patenting the same thing as a result of the presence or absence of a grace period in that jurisdiction.
So there is one thing that would come into play there, and this is a question that came up a lot when the U.S. changed to this first to file, people started clarifying it's the first inventor to file. So if someone sees your publication, they can't claim that it was their invention. So if they didn't actually invent it, they can't file a patent application for it. So your publication would have the same impact on others outside the U.S. that it would have on you outside the U.S., for example, where there's no grace period. Does that answer your question?
I think so, yeah, thanks.
Okay, sure. Sebastian, is that another question from you?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up question. So it's like if one company has a trade secret, so it's like they have secretly made the same invention that someone else is publishing, would Hillary's case apply then?
Well, this is one that would vary by country, but just generally speaking, if there's a company that develops an invention and never publishes it, always keeps it internally, and then another company independently creates the same invention and files a patent application, then they can get a patent. So a prior secret knowledge of something does not prevent someone else from getting a patent if they independently develop it. If someone leaves the company and says, oh, they never published that, so I'm going to go patent it, they couldn't do that. That would violate a number of different laws. But one of the reasons they couldn't patent it is because they themselves didn't invent it. But even if they did, it would probably violate their terms of employment. So,
thanks.
Sure. Great questions. This is fun. Let's see. I wanted to talk about this. I think some of what the questions that we've gotten so far kind of do lead to this topic of patent ownership versus inventorship. So I've got a blog post here at the bottom. This is one of the, you know, we can see our web traffic, and this blog post gets a lot of web traffic, which was very unexpected to me. Because it's a relatively simple rule, but I think a lot of people are curious about this. So the inventors for a patent are the individual people who conceived the claim invention, and conceived means that they formed the idea in their head. It doesn't include reduction to practice, which reduction to practice just means that you've actually implemented the invention. If you develop an algorithm and you sort of invent the algorithm, you conceive it, sketch it out, and then you ask, someone that's working with you to code up the algorithm to, you know, test it out. If they simply code they write some code that implements the invention that you conceived, then that person is not an inventor because they reduced the invention to practice. They didn't conceive it. However, if that person adds to the invention, if they say, oh, there's a problem with the algorithm, here's how I fixed it. If that becomes part of the invention, then of course that person is an inventor. But one thing that's important about inventorship, I think this will be particularly relevant for this audience, is that inventorship is always determined by legal standards. And that is distinguished from things like politics or agreements or all the different types of things that can influence who gets credit in other contexts. So it's not uncommon at all to have a journal article that is published for some piece of research, and then also to have a patent application that's filed for the same piece of research. And the inventors on the patent application might be just two or three of the authors who were listed on the journal paper. And I think you guys being involved in research will understand that a lot of times people are listed on a journal article for reasons other than the sort of hard work and innovation that was done to solve problems. So that's important to know. Inventorship is sometimes inventorship and ownership is the same. They don't always have to be different, but they are different concepts. So the owner of a patent is the entity, and I say entity because it's very often a business, the entity that controls the patent rights and receives the benefits of the patent rights. So all the things that were bulleted out on the slide earlier about, you know, exclusivity and royalties and things like that, those are benefits for the patent owner. And also the patent owner is the one who files patent applications, pays for patent applications. And ownership is typically determined by agreement. So I showed you the number of patents earlier. I showed you the number of patents that are filed by big tech companies. And so that kind of shows you that the vast majority of patents are filed by companies, tech companies. And in that context, the ownership is determined by an employment agreement. So IBM, I think, was at the top of the list. And I would guess that everybody or almost everyone at IBM has an employment agreement that says IBM owns everything. But also there's a lot of other types of agreements that can affect ownership. You know, collaboration agreements between research institutions are a great example. You know, there are scenarios where a business is funding some research at a university, and that is usually, there's usually some sort of collaboration or joint development agreement that goes along with that. And that agreement, you know, should say who's going to own patent rights. And it could be, you know, that the company will own patent rights for this specific area, and then the university or whoever will own all the other patent rights. There's a lot of different ways it can be diced up. But if there's not an agreement, then in most scenarios, in the US, it's almost all scenarios, there's a default that the inventors are the initial owners. Outside the US, there's some exceptions for employment, but the default is generally that the inventors own the patent. And then just a little bit of vocabulary, the type of agreement that transfers ownership of a patent is called an assignment. And so, you know, the company that receives ownership is called the assignee. And that will come back into play later when I show you some example patents, but the company that receives ownership is often referred to as the assignee. Okay, so this is, I think, gets into a lot of the questions that have been asked already. And it's just basic requirements for patentability. What do you need to get a patent? And these are kind of, you can think of them as hurdles that you have to clear for the patent office to approve your patent application. And just at a high level, you have patent eligible subject matter, which means, is this the type of thing that can be patented? Just as an example, in the US, diagnostic, like medical diagnostics, are just not patentable. And that is due to a Supreme Court decision. But it doesn't matter how innovative or special the diagnostic method is, it's just not patentable. That's an example, but that's not true in Europe, for example. You can patent diagnostics at some level. So every country has its own exclusions. And this kind of goes back to one of the questions that was asked earlier about, can you patent knowledge in the US versus Canada? And I think that the difference at a high level there is patent eligible subject matter. So novelty is another hurdle. And this one is, you know, assuming that you're patent eligible, which most things are patent eligible, then it has to be, the invention has to be novel. It has, and that is an objective criteria. It has to be objectively different from, and I have prior art here in quotes because that encompasses a whole lot of stuff that's on the next slide, but basically everything that came before your invention, products, published papers, whatever, there has to be something that's objectively different. And then a more, I think, in practice, it turns out to be somewhat more subjective hurdle to clear is that difference has to be non-obvious. This is also called, this is also referred to as the inventive step requirement. And the invention or the difference from the prior art has to be something that would not have been obvious to a person of ordinary skill in the art, in view of the prior art. And I think the thing to highlight there is that, you know, at Perimeter, you're all experts. You're not a person of ordinary skill in the art. So if something is obvious to you, that doesn't mean that it's not patentable. A lot of things that are obvious to you would not have been obvious to a person of ordinary skill. And that's one thing that I think just requires time and experience. So there are a lot of companies that I work with that as they go through the patent process, the patent system with a number of different patent applications, they start to understand, they start to develop an instinct for the types of things that would be considered non-obvious that maybe they wouldn't have realized that before going through the experience. So, and then the fourth requirement here is written description, which that's really the patent attorney's job or the patent drafter's job. You have to write the patent application with enough detail to enable a person of ordinary skill in the art to make and use the invention. So you have to teach, basically. You have to teach the reader how to make and use the invention. And then you also have to show possession of the invention, which just means you have to describe it in concrete terms that someone can really understand what the boundaries of the invention are. And then there's a best mode requirement that you're supposed to tell the patent office the best way of making and using the invention. You can't hold that back for yourself and keep it a secret. I think just as important as the requirements are the things that are not required. So you do not have to reduce the invention to practice. In other words, you don't have to build a prototype. You don't have to have data. You don't have to prove that it works. There are some exceptions to this. As a physics audience, you'll probably appreciate that if you claim a perpetual motion machine, you do have to have a working prototype. This has actually come into play for me a number of times. So having a background in quantum physics, when I used to work at a big law firm with hundreds of attorneys, and every once in a while, someone would come with a crazy idea and they would kind of send it to me because they kind of put quantum physics in the category of crazy ideas, I guess. And I, a number of times, had someone who they didn't call it a perpetual motion machine, but when you actually got down to the substance of what they were claiming was their invention, it turned out to be a perpetual motion machine. And so I had to kind of tell them that they need to have a working prototype. And of course, you can guess how that turned out. That's the exception. However, I do want to say that it is useful if you have some data, if you have a prototype, if you can actually show that the invention works, that's good. It's useful. Put it in your patent application. But for technology patents, it's not required. For some types of patents, it is, like pharmaceuticals, you actually do have to have some data, but I don't think that's relevant for this audience. Okay. So what is prior art? And this is a very loaded term. I've got a blog post here that you can look at. This is probably the second most highly trafficked post on our website, because I think people run into this question a lot. So there's two general categories. And the first category is earlier filed patents and patent applications. So there's a patent that was filed before yours, then it's prior art. And anything in that patent can be used to show that your invention is not novel and non-obvious. So in the prior slide, I said it has to be objectively different from the prior art. And the prior art includes any patent application that was filed before yours. There are some exceptions to that. If it's your own work or if it's co-owned, then it can be excluded in certain cases. And then the second category is anything that's made available to the public before you file your patent application. So that would be written publications, which we've talked about. It could be an archive post. It could be a blog post. It could be a journal publication. Any kind of written publication, it could be a public use, If you demo an invention at a trade show, that is prior art. Anything that is sold or offered for sale. This is one that varies by country, but in the US, even if you privately offer something for sale to someone, confidentially offer it for sale, that still can be considered prior art. And then, of course, you know, products that are sold publicly are prior art. And then, you know, public disclosures like this presentation, if there were any technical content to it, would be prior art to a later filed patent application. And then again, there are these exceptions. This is the grace period exception. So this can be important, you know, when you're actually looking at a particular invention to know whether it's going to be patentable. So I think we've got about 15 minutes left, and we start to get a little bit more away for the rest of the presentation, a little bit less in the substance of patent law and what's patentable, and more into kind of the more nuts and bolts practical aspects of, okay, how do you actually get a patent then? And I think it's always helpful to look at to start with thinking about the full lifetime of a patent. And I have here on the top sort of a life of a patent timeline that shows that it begins with, on the far left, with someone developing the invention, that kind of starts the process. And then there's a patent application filed, and eventually at the red bar there, that's when the patent is issued. And then the patent is in force, if you will, for this whole longer time. It's usually 20 to 25 years. The typical timeline is 20 years from the filing date, from the earliest claim to priority date. And so that can be extended or modified, but it's a 20-year timeline, just generally speaking. And so then we zoom in on this first early period of the life of the patent. And this is where my work is, basically. And this is where I guess my work usually starts, at the purple and blue part, and then usually kind of stops at the red part. There's a totally separate world of patent attorneys, believe it or not, who do all of the enforcement and licensing. So this 3 to 5 year timeline, you're drafting a patent application, then you file a patent application, and there's a long, you know, multi-year period where you're prosecuting your patent application with various patent offices throughout the world, or just one patent office. And I think, you know, one thing that's important to know, and you probably have a sense for this if you've ever been involved with patents, that there's a lot of different ways to file a patent application, and the different permutations of and variations of what you can do here, they actually start to add up very quickly. And so there's quite a number of different paths to getting issued patents. Probably the default or the typical is just a national filing. So you file a patent application with the Canadian Patent Office or the US Patent Office, Chinese Patent Office, and then that patent office examines it, approves it, you get a patent. There are also regional filings. So the European Patent Office, I think, is the main example, where the European Patent Office will examine your patent application, and then if they approve it, then you can take that approval to all the different member countries and get a patent in those specific countries. There are also international applications under it's called the Patent Cooperation Treaty. We call these PCT applications. You might've heard that before. And a PCT application is basically a placeholder. It does get examined, but the examination doesn't really have any binding consequence. So the international application kind of sits there, and it buys you time to file national applications in individual countries. So just as an example, you could file a PCT application, and then up to 2.5 years later, you could take that PCT application and file it in the US, in Europe, in China, and Canada. So you still, even though there's an international application, PCT application, you still have to go to the individual patent offices and do these national or regional filings. So in other words, there's no such thing as an international patent. And then finally, this is a pretty popular type of patent filing. A lot of people hear about provisional applications. It's really only available in the US. But I usually describe these as informal patent applications because the patent office doesn't examine them. They don't really have many requirements at all. I was told early in my career, if you can put in a flatbed scanner, then you can file it as a provisional application. And so it's informal in the sense that you can kind of file anything. It often can be done quickly and at lower cost, which, for certain scenarios, it comes in handy to be able to file something quickly at lower cost. And there's a whole topic that we could talk about on provisional applications. And I've got a link here to a blog post where you can read more if you want, but they often are kind of used as a stopgap measure. Sometimes they do not have the same legal effect as a full patent application. And so I would just say, use caution when filing provisional applications. Don't assume that it's giving you the same protection as a full formal application. So if you, as a innovator, are involved in filing a patent application, there's a few things that I think are extremely useful to know at the front end, but while you're in the process of working on the patent application, that you would want to know up front. And so I've kind of bulleted those out here. But after you file a patent application, and it's pending at the patent office, you can amend the claims, which means that you can change the exact boundaries and wording of what you say is your exclusive invention, but you can't add new technical material to the patent application. So if you're going to amend the claims, you have to have some basis for doing that in the original patent application. So the point there is that you're limited in what you can do after the patent application has been filed. It's not uncommon after a patent application has been filed for new prior art references to emerge. And the reason for that is patent examiners tend to search. So when a patent examiner picks up a patent application, they start searching for prior art that's relevant to your invention. And they will typically search for prior patents because those are well documented. The dates and content of those are well documented. And, you know, examiners know patents. And so it's natural for them to search there. Patents by default, or I should say patent applications by default, are not published until at least 18 months after they've been filed. So it's possible that someone files a patent application for the same invention a year before you, and you'd have no way of finding that because it wasn't published. Well, a year after you file yours, the examiner finds it, now it's published. That patent application that was, there was no way that you could have known about it when you filed your patent application, the prior filing can prevent you from getting a patent. And of course, you know, there's no way to uncover all the prior art, even with a thorough search. So there's sometimes a patent examiner will find something that you just didn't know about. Patent office policy and patent law is subject to change. And I think the patent eligible subject matter that I talked about earlier, that's a great example of, I mean, there are a lot of patent applications that when they were filed, they would have been patentable. And then the law changed. And 2 years later, that same invention is no longer patentable. That's kind of rare for it to happen at the level that it has happened recently. But patent office policy in terms of how they handle certain scenarios, it does change with, you know, different patent office directors and things. So the law changes. Every patent office does its own independent examination. So if you get a US patent, that does not mean that the Canadian patent office is going to approve your patent application in Canada. They're going to do their own investigation. And then finally, there's a duty to disclose prior art to the US patent office. So when you, and the US is sort of unique in this regard, but when you file a U.S. patent application, you have to tell the patent office all the closest prior art that you're aware of. So I think we're just about at the end of the hour here. So I was going to go through the anatomy of a patent, but we can maybe save that for another day if you want.
That sounds great, Michael. Thank you very much. It's a terrific presentation. I just want to ask, do the students have any questions? Are there students on the line? Are there any questions in general or comments? Or okay. If not, what we'll do, there, as Michael said, we're going to have another session on patents where we really start to look at the anatomy of them. How do you write them? What do you put in the claims? What do the diagrams look like? How do you present when you have an idea, you know, in a conference? Can you do that? We'll go through those areas on the next colloquia next year in January. Michael, thank you very much indeed for putting this together for us. It's really informative, and
great
next session.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed it. Really honored to be here. So thank you all.
And thanks everyone for attending. That's great. Bye-bye.